Yes. You are listening to WFVR 96.5 on the FM dial and streaming on the web. Royalton Community Radio, Free Vermont Radio. And this is Green Zine. And I'm your host, Henry Swayze, today. Todd is off in Maine, or returning probably. He's about on his way back, sucking up some of that ocean breeze. And we have a jam-packed show with two guests today on Green Zine. We'll have Senator Dick McCormick from Bethel, who is just closing out his 30 years plus at the legislature. And we have Bill Mormau, who is has spent his life in forestry, has been involved with international decisions and working up information on carbon in forests and how that plays a role in climate. So we have two people who have spent many, many years bathing in what you do about climate. And we will move in and join them to think about this. I want to start by thanking our sponsors, because without our sponsors, Free Vermont Radio wouldn't be free anymore. Solarflect, solar panel tracking company using super lightweight construction to conserve steel and resource materials to do that job of generating electricity from the sun. Bale, build a local economy with their Vermont office right here on the green in South Royalton. And Royal Trail Works, who have supported us since the beginning of Green Zine, 11 years plus, or 11 years and running at this point. And TrailWorks designs all sorts of trails through the forest to make us enjoy not only skiing, but hiking and all sorts of things. Daniel Leibowitz, who was a founding member of Royalton Community Radio and has gone off to Washington, D.C. to wade in the swamp down there. Hopefully he's planting some of those trees that are soaking up the carbon right on the water's edge. Upper Pass Beer Company, based in Tunbridge and here on the South Royalton Green, offering their yummy beer. I had some very good stuff from them at the party, that staff party for Royalton Community Radio a week or so ago. First Branch Coffee Company, also down here on the green. And Solarfest, who is a rebuilding year working on their campus to have a great live Solar Fest next year. White River Land Collaborative, who is located in Tunbridge and is trying to have, again, a sustainable environment with local food production and land available to people who want to generate more of their food from the land. And lastly, Wit and Grit from Randolph, a breakfast and luncheon restaurant. And if you go to wittandgrit.com, you can see all the good offerings that they have. So without any further ado, I'm going to jump into migratory birds. And in particular, we're going to do birds' ability to see the landscape that they are flying over and direct them in their migratory efforts. I guess it would help if I turned on the channel I'm on.
All migration season. You might see a bloom of movement on the screen, but it doesn't look like a rain cloud. Oh, it's a flock of birds.
Let's take this from the top.
If you happen to look at a radar weather forecast on a cloudless night during this fall migration season, you might see a bloom of movement on the screen. But it doesn't look like a rain cloud. Oh, it's a flock of birds. The radar systems meteorologists use to forecast weather are also remarkably good at detecting birds, insects, and bats. The biologists can use that to keep track of migrating birds. Radar works by sending out radio pulses that bounce off objects in the atmosphere and calculating how long it takes for the signal to return to the source. Computer programs can interpret the signal to distinguish whether it came from a raindrop or a robin. Birdwatchers can use this technology too, with BirdCast. It's an online resource that combines decades of biological research, community science observations, and radar data to forecast the movements of migratory birds. BirdCast shows live maps that track flocks as they travel through your region, and you can use this information to plan a birding trip or choose the best morning to rise in time to hear the migrants' dawn chorus. For more information on using BirdCast to check up on migrating birds in your area, visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Join Bird.
Yeah, that's a bird note from last year about this time, and we'll post a link on the Greenzine links for BirdCast so that you can tune into that and have a look at that if you want. So without further ado, let's jump into our guests. And here in the studio, I have Dick McCormick.
And,
yeah.
Good to be here.
Let's see if I get your mic about right here.
Yeah, we didn't do a sound check.
No, this is live radio.
This is folky, down-home radio.
Yeah. Okay. So, welcome to Greenzine, Dick.
Well, it's good to be. I listen to you folks, I think it's wonderful what you're doing. That when you talk about live radio, I mean live as in radio that's alive. Real people with real thoughts and real music.
Yeah. So before we get in, I'm going to get you to start off with some music. But before we get into that, let me introduce you to William Morma, who is also on the line. Bill, welcome to Greenzine.
Thank you very much for having me, Henry. And it's nice to meet Senator McCormick.
Hi.
Hi.
All right. Never done this before with different guests and different people in different places. This is definitely an experiment. All right. Well, let's give Dick McCormick a chance to we'll kind of spend the majority of the first half hour with him, and then we'll switch over. But you're certainly welcome to join anywhere you long. You're up and live, and Dick's has had a dual personality. He's been a folk singer, maybe ahead of being a legislator.
Oh yeah, many years.
and it's never gone away. So I think he's going to do a number that that the VNRC, the Vermont Natural Resources Council, asked him to write.
Yeah, they actually, I was a commission.
The commission got paid for it. It's
it
real.
To commemorate the 10th anniversary of Act 250. Uh-huh. Of course, we now just had the 50th. So this song goes back quite a way.
Whoa.
And you would ask specifically, because we're discussing environmental issues, that I do an environmental-related song. I always tried to separate my musical life from my political life. I didn't want to be the singing senator. I thought that was too much of a novelty act. But I cannot escape it. Of any song I ever wrote, the most popular was Voices in the Hills. Had it in at the line about a Vermont farm family go broke from paying taxes or get rich from selling land. And as a senator, I've been one of the more active and vocal defenders of current use program, which addresses that very program. So these things overlap. And this song, it was for the VNRC, and I performed it at a VNRC banquet where one of the guests was then Lieutenant Governor Madeline Cunin. And that's how she and I met one another.
Wow.
And I got into the Senate when she appointed me to serve out an unexpired term. So this song sort of started my political career.
Good woman.
Yeah. We live in the ruts of the long glacial spring. The scars on the land that millennia bring, the tracks of a giant and wild ancient thing that make us all one with the land. One and all are one with the land. Our footpaths are humble, our mountains are grand. Each summer the wild berries bleed in our hands to christen us one with the land. Water that percolates, sparkling and cold. Water that waters our bodies and souls. Water that waters the land that we know and makes us all one with the land. One and all are one with the land. Footpaths are humble and mountains are grand. Each summer the wild berries bleed in our hands to christen us one with the land. The trees of our walls and our fires have long stood in the darks and the depths and the smells of the woods to inform us some things are transcendently good and that we're all one with the land. Echoes of geese where the gaggles have flown, whitetails and families and wildcats alone, sisters and brothers in blood and in bone, and all of us one with the land. One and all are one with the land. Our footpaths are humble, our mountains are grand. Each summer the wild berries bleed in our hands and christen us one with the land. So parents, beware, our daughters and sons will live out their lives with what can't be undone. Benign or malignant, all we'll have done as one with the land. One and all are one with the land. Our footprints paths are humble, our mountains are grand. Each summer the wild berries bleed in our hands and christen us one with the land. Each summer the wild berries bleed in our hands and christen us one with the land.
Yeah, I like that. That's right on the theme with with the woods and with biodiversity and all the things that maybe have a chance to help us out with climate and with the global warming that's going on.
Thanks. Yeah, and I've always worried that song has a little bit of a happy backpacker feel to it.
It does. It
John
does.
Denver feel it, or maybe almost a German, we are happy students romping in Lederhosen through the Black Forest kind of feel. Up-tempo waltz.
We need positive things. We can't be a gloom and doom because it immobilizes us.
That's right.
So thank you for for having a little upbeat in that.
And thank you, Madeline Keenan.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That was the beginning of a great trip for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about kind of, a lot has happened in the legislature in the last 2-year period. On climate and the environment, a little bit on fixing living in a more sustainable way, getting more people living in villages instead of traveling so far to go anywhere. I live on 4.5 miles of dirt road, and when I'm here, I can come to South Royalton to the co-op. But when I first moved here, the only supermarket was in White River Junction, and it was an A&P with floors that weren't level and high ceilings, and it didn't have a great deal in it, but it was a good store to shops, as you know, to fill up your larder at. And we used to go there once a month, and that was the extent of our travel.
Going to market.
Going to market. Yeah. Yes. And now it seems like when I'm in Tunbridge, everything is at least 20 minutes away, and a lot of things are 35 minutes away. I split my time between here and right in the middle of Burlington. And when I'm in Burlington, I can risk my life and bike to almost anything. Some of it needs to have the, especially when you want to cross the interstate, on the bridges, they're way too congested and don't have enough pedestrian and bike friendliness. So, but everything is less than 10 minutes away.
Well, if you look at the placement of Vermont's old villages just throughout the state, they are well placed for the 19th century, where to get from the farm to the village for marketing, or to go to the bank, or talk to your lawyer, or to go to church.
You were governed by horseback speed.
Yeah, and that at that about the same speed. That's now more or less what it takes to get to West Leb to go shopping, and that's why we're land use and the human footprint on the land is a problem because now what. A village every 6 or 7 miles made sense in the 19th century. Now, what makes sense is sprawl, yeah. Suburban sprawl. And that does make economic sense. In an election time, my Republican colleagues will often say, well, Democrats are really just crypto-socialists. I believe in the law of supply and demand. I believe in market forces.
Yeah.
I'm a capitalist supporter in that regard. However, nothing in this world is entirely benign. And sometimes market forces have pernicious effects. And that's where we have to make political decisions. Yeah. The market wants us to do this, and we don't want to do this. So we're going to have to do something different. The market wants us to sprawl. And you see it. It used to be compact villages surrounded by open green countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. now what if you mentioned Burlington, Addison County is a very good example of just its highways ringed by commercial development for the entire length of the highway.
Yeah.
From Burlington to Shelburne, it's all commercial. Yeah. And similarly with housing. The sparsely settled countryside, and where it is settled, it's settled by, you would see a farmhouse and barn and outbuildings, and surrounded by 100 acres of farmland.
Yeah.
And now what you get, everyone wants their own little yard, including me. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone else. I drove here this morning.
Me too.
Yeah. And it's the way we have organized ourselves as a society. But what we now have is everyone wants 10 acres or 5 acres. And you get the fields filling up with houses if left to market forces. So we are trying to contrive a better land use. And, of course, going back to the beginning of my political career was about Act 250.
Yeah.
A Republican law written by Vermont Republicans.
Yeah.
Not Trumpers, but real Vermont Republicans. And I've said, I'm a Democrat. I've spent my career defending Dean Davis's work.
Yeah.
He was the governor at the time. Gibb was the leader in the Senate on environment. And Dean Davis said it best. He said, the dilemma for Vermont is that our beauty is a function of our poverty.
It's true.
And so the idea is, how can you have it? Can you have it both ways? Yeah. Can we prosper without trashing land?
Yeah. There was a woman that we actually had on the radio maybe 10 years ago who wrote a book about why Vermont was what it looks like. And it was because we survived the Depression and came through that. And we weren't really on the way to anywhere, and there were no highways. That was pre-interstates. Yeah. And so we got left alone and didn't get suburbanized.
Yeah, which was good and bad. It was an economic backwater.
Poor.
It was and poor. Vermonters, older Vermonters often would say, we didn't realize there was a depression.
That's right.
We were always poor.
So I bought my farm in 1965, and when you drove down 110, at least 2/3 of the houses were in need of paint.
Yeah,
there was no cash. It was, but people made a living off the land. If they weren't farming and growing their own food and selling food,
yeah,
they were at least involved with a spinoff of that logging or some sideline that was connected to the land.
Yeah, we are unfortunately. Now people, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true that we have two Vermonts. Because as you drive around Vermont now, you will see a lot of places in ill repair. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they don't care. It's because they can't afford to upgrade and to maintain. And that meanwhile, statistically, Vermont is a prosperous state. We have a high income state. Well, yes, there's some people. And you average, if you're standing at the door of a furnace and it's 20 degrees below zero outside, on average, you're comfortable. Half of you is in the furnace, half of you out in the cold. On the average, you're comfortable. And Vermont is sort of that way, too, is that we have there's actually a lot of good, there's a lot of income in this state, but a lot of people are not seeing any of it. And so it's, I am leaving the Senate after actually 35 years.
35.
Well, I was sworn in November 89, and I'll leave in January 25. So if I count both of those years, it's been a long career. And I am, as I leave, we're dealing with the same issues we were dealing with when I arrived in the Senate, one of which is land use. Yeah. And how do you prosper? Again, Dean Davis, our beauty is a function of our poverty. How do you prosper without destroying the land? Because going back to Dean Davis, which is now back in the 60s, and you mentioned what Vermont was an economic backwater, and then with the end of World War II, we have the interstate, you have the ski industry. Vermont had always been a tourist destination in the summer. We now had what was supposed to be a second season, kind of took over Vermont tourism. You have the interstate highways, and you have the GI Bill, and a boom in housing and so on. You have a level of prosperity surrounding us.
Yeah.
And we now became a half a day's drive from New York, at least southwestern, the Bennington area, the Mount Snow area, which is sort of what inspired Act 250. That was like, you know, 4 or 5 hours from New York City. And so suddenly you have this opportunity to create unprecedented prosperity in Vermont. And the two camps were, on the one hand, a lot of people who were saying, bring it on. The old days were nice, but let's not be sentimental. Bring it on. And if Vermont starts to look like Long Island, so well, that's the price we pay for this prosperity. Bring it on. And then you had people who said, you know, Vermont's pretty good the way it is. And I don't know if I want to see it changed. And you had that ruthless development philosophy versus no growth. Dean Davis and Art Gibb and those good old Vermont Republicans, they said, we do want development. We do want the prosperity. But when you do it, you got to do it right.
Yeah.
And that's what Act 250 review has always been. It is expensive, time-consuming, and inconvenient for a lot of people. And that's the price you pay to have good development that doesn't trash the place. And I've done a lot of things in my political career, but that's really, I think, been sort of the center of it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that this all does tie back to climate change. Climate change is now challenging us. I mean, you look at what just happened to Florida, but they're in the eye of the storm, as it were. They will continue to, and they're in denial about it.
It's breathtaking, and in the Windsor County Senate race, I went to at the law school a candidates forum, and you know, one of the candidates said he was skeptical about man-caused global warming.
Right.
And, you know, so, no, that's not skepticism. Skepticism is finding the faults in the other side's argument. Skepticism is being unconvinced because the argument to convince you is not a strong argument.
Right.
Being confronted with the proof and still denying it, that's not skepticism. That's boneheadedness. And in this case, people die because of the boneheadedness. And the destruction, I mean, we just saw it. I've got family in Florida. That's what I was doing this morning before coming here, is texting family in Florida. They're okay.
Wow.
But they described it as really pretty devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. Are they interior Florida?
Tampa.
Tampa. Wow.
Yeah.
But not on the right out there on the in the brunt of it.
So what they say there, they said evacuate, but if you're not going to evacuate, run from water and hide from wind.
Yeah.
And That makes sense.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, global warming, I have made become an object of ridicule to my colleagues for using the same phrase over and over. But we've gone beyond ridicule. Now they all quote me. They chuckle when they do. But they all quote. And it is this. And I didn't invent this. Global warming is the overarching existential issue of our time.
Yeah.
Nothing else rises to the level of global warming.
That's where I've been at for I actually started paying attention to climate change shortly after I moved to Vermont in 65.
Yeah.
Because we were seeing extreme cold weather then, and I was trying to figure out, well, what's this all about? And then
I
just watched it swing around from extreme cold to extreme heat and extreme flood. I mean, you've been going to legislature and watching Mount Pilliar underwater.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
2 years in a row.
That's right. The I don't want to be pretentious here. I have never read Schopenhauer, but I got a great quote from Schopenhauer off a box of Celestial Seasonings. And I use this a lot too, but because I repeat myself because this needs to be repeated. He said, every important idea goes through three phases. First, it is mocked as ridiculous. Yeah. Then it is vehemently and angrily opposed as dangerous. And finally, it's held to have always been self-evident. And 20 years ago, Rush Limbaugh would talk about environmental wackos, these environmental wackos. Like there was something crazy about respecting the science.
Yeah.
Today, you still have some folks like that. You do.
Yeah.
But
they're hiding under their hats now.
Well, they're not all hiding. Some are, but they enjoy crazy uncle status.
Right.
But we certainly have the angry backlash. The legislature passed what I regard as a very, very mediocre, timid climate bill.
Yeah.
And yet you have people running for public office that their main issue is elect me because these environmental wackos put in this Clean Energy Act.
Right.
And, you know, and, well, yeah, we did.
The transportation piece, I don't think they've cured that one.
Oh, yeah.
So let me bring Bill in because I think he has his finger on two things, pulling carbon back out of the atmosphere, and we seem to be slow to stop burning things which puts carbon in the atmosphere, whether that is whether that's firewood or oil. It all is putting carbon in the atmosphere. And I think we need to focus on getting it out of the atmosphere. And I think we're not making as good decisions in doing that as we could. And then I have my other pet side, which is if we could shut down carbon emissions altogether, just blink, we still have many, many, many years of warming built in.
Because it's there.
Because we put it up. And so I think that Bill's specialty is forests, and I think forests also give us cooling capacity, that is cooling now rather than just waiting for the carbon to have bled out of the system. So welcome to Green Zine, Bill.
Good. Thank you very much for having me, and it's very interesting to hear. I live in my in Massachusetts, but my northern property line is Vermont. So I'm almost in Pownal. And Bennington's actually the closest city to us, or town of any size. And so, my grandson is now a first-year student at Middlebury College. So we're getting up there more frequently than we did before.
Wow. Well, that's... welcome as an almost Vermonter. So let's get right into the meat of what you have studied and promulgated, and I don't know how many years you've been at this. Have you been doing it for a similar number of years as well, Dick?
I began getting really interested in teaching. I'm a chemist, actually, and I was in the chemistry department at Williams College, and I started there in the mid-60s and began teaching one of the first environmental science courses. A lot of that focused on energy, and I actually spent the first half of my climate career working almost exclusively on understanding the technologies that are causing it and the changes we could make to stop using those technologies and reduce our emissions. I mean, there's just no question that we have to stop putting it in. But we're at a point now, as you correctly point out, where we also have to be taking more of it out because we have these legacy emissions going back, starting in 1750 with the Industrial Revolution, that have exceeded the capacity of natural systems to keep carbon dioxide in particular, but also methane, which is also naturally in the atmosphere, but we've added immensely to that, and nitrous oxide, which is naturally in the atmosphere, but we have, again, through agriculture, using nitrogen fertilizer, have added immense amounts of that, and that has a roughly 300-year half-life. Carbon dioxide has a probably several thousand-year half-life. So we've got to find some way to hurry up the removal if we're going to actually reduce the risks of having more of these kinds of events, extreme events, whether it's wildfires in California and the West and Canada, or whether it's hurricanes that we're experiencing in the eastern U.S. And, you know, I have some very good friends who are in Asheville, North Carolina, which was considered climate safe. Yes. It was just devastated by Hurricane Helene. And we have to remember the 1938 hurricane that devastated right up through this part of the world. Irene, which more recently devastated a lot of this part of the world. That one, I remember, basically disabled virtually all the east-west roads across Massachusetts and Vermont. I mean, you just couldn't get there from here. if you're going east to west. Yeah. And these are getting worse. It should be obvious to everyone. I mean, these two storms in that have hit Florida in the southeast are absolutely unprecedented what we're seeing is not more hurricanes, but more hurricanes that are very intense. The reason for that is because global warming has warmed the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic, and hurricanes derive their energy from the heat of the ocean and the extra water that's evaporated. 20 inches they got in some parts of Florida from this last hurricane. That's devastating no matter where it happens.
It doesn't make any difference if you're on a flatland or in the mountains. It's too much water for anything to hold except for a lake.
That's right. And even, you know, we think of sea level rise, but lakes rise faster when you get that much water in them in a short period of time. And so there's been a lot of just enormous damage and loss of lives because we've not prevented the intensification, and then we've not prepared for the consequences. So we've just made the situation worse for ourselves because we want to keep doing things the way we've always been doing them, and that's to burn fossil fuels for our transportation and for our heating our homes and for industry. The good news is, and this is what I worked on for the first 25 years of my career, was the development of things like solar panels, which are now affordable. When I started working on them, the only place that could afford them was NASA, and that was to put them on satellites and send them into space. Yes. But to power their satellites, price was no object, and that just didn't work for most people. So now it does work for most people because it's the least cost thing you can do. And I decided to test this out. I served on five of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, starting with the second one in 1996 and going through special report on renewable energy and whatever that was, 2010 or something. And I learned from all the people I worked with from all over the world and from all the different technologies they were working with what was happening. And so I decided, I think we're at a point where we could try to do this. And I was facing the prospect I'd be retiring within the next decade and decided that we wanted to build the house that we wanted to live in. And so we built, we were very fortunate. We found an architect, an engineer, and a builder. And the engineer turned out to be Mark Rosenbaum, who is probably the most prominent building efficiency engineers in New England. And he engineered and the architect designed and the contractor built one of the first zero net energy homes in New England.
Wow.
In Williamstown, Massachusetts. And we're connected to the grid. I asked him about being off grid and he said, you don't want to do that because in July you'll be producing huge amounts of surplus electricity and with your panels. And if you're connected to the grid, you can send that back in the grid and your neighbors can use it. And so it actually helps solve the problem more broadly than just your own personal contribution of not using any fossil fuel electricity to run your home, heat it, light it, run your computers, run your washing machine.
And I bet you were doing it all very efficiently, that this was not a leaky house.
That you are right. That was the first thing that we did was solar panels were still pretty expensive then. And it was probably if we did things the way most houses are built, we didn't have a roof big enough to put enough solar panels on. So we began literally with every light bulb, with every appliance, and then we did the building envelope. Look to see how efficient did we have to make the building envelope so that with the early heat pumps, ground source heat pumps that they had at the time, that we could actually keep this house comfortable, which we did all this. We moved in 2007. We still had occasional 0-degree days in the winter here in Williamstown. We don't have any of those anymore in just that short period of time. So it's a very tight house. We have mechanical ventilation, which brings in fresh air from outside that's cold, and we preheat that with the exhausting stale air that's warm as it comes in. And we were able to, in the second year, after a little shakedown things in the first year, we were able to meet the situation where we exported more electricity from our solar panels to the grid than electricity we drew from the grid.
Yeah.
And we're very comfortable in this house. I mean, it's the most comfortable house you can imagine, because there are no drafts at all. There are no leaky windows. And at the time, even though we had been through the oil shocks of the 70s, there were no windows made in the United States that would allow us to build a house that would meet those conditions. So we discovered that there's a place north of us called Canada where they kept developing better windows and things like that. And so we had to import our windows from Canada and our doors from Canada and our air exchange, thermal air exchanger from Canada and a few other things. But we really managed to do it. And people always say, well, the one thing we did not do, which is not very New England, is we decided not to put in a fireplace because fireplaces are terribly...
Yeah, it's a big,
terribly leaky.
It's a big open window.
It's just a big hole in your roof, and they suck out more warm air from your house than the heat they give you in the immediate space. Yeah. And so, for the cost of not putting in, for avoiding the cost of the chimney, we were able to buy the solar panels.
Yeah, wow.
And our rate of return on our investment for the solar panels was about 8 years, and then we were making money. If you think of it as an investment rather than as a cost, and you look at how much we saved from heating and lighting bills, and so we have no electric bills.
I invited you on here to try to get into carbon sequestration. And I think you have gone directly to maybe the thing that we pay the least attention to, which is increasing our efficiency and win-win that is.
Yes.
It's a win for the environment, and it's a win for our own personal comfort and lifestyle.
And our bank account, frankly.
So it's a triple win.
Triple win. That's right.
Yeah.
And so then, having done that, almost 6 years ago now, I bought an electric vehicle, which I added more solar panels for, and I sometimes have to drive as far as Boston or Burlington, and so I can't charge all my miles there, but it's about 60% of the miles I drive are charged from my solar panels.
Mm.
So there's another saving that mounts up. Yeah. And having done that, though, we have these what are called legacy concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we've been putting in since forever. And we do it in two major ways. One is we burn fossil fuels and we burn firewood. And the second is we cut down forests, and which are nature's number one way of removing carbon dioxide. The number two way, which is right behind it, is oceans. Mm-hmm. So we degrade our forests and we degrade our oceans. And as a result, we have upset the system that maintained the climate that allowed all of civilization to develop. I find that to be remarkable.
You want to repeat that once more.
Yeah, that if you think about it, the whole beginning with the agricultural revolution about just after the last ice age, so 10 or 12,000 years ago, urbanization, civilization as we know it, the Industrial Revolution, everything occurred in a period of relatively benign global climate that was relatively stable. And anthropologists and others say that, you know, prior to the possibility of staying in one place with agriculture to feed ourselves and urbanization where we could develop all the wonderful things we've been able to develop, the arts, the sciences, just everything we think of as civilization, has occurred during that period and could not occur before, because we had to be nomads running around with wildly fluctuating climate temperatures and so forth. So everything we have is because we lived in a stable, benign climate, and we have disrupted that by adding so much more heat trapping gases to the atmosphere, and then destroying the capacity of nature to remove it. But you know, nature is not vindictive, and even though we've removed over a third of the forests that originally were here in the world, and even more of that in the United States, if forests had not been doing their job worldwide, we would have achieved the current amount of extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we have today in 1960. And our concentrations today, which are now, well, before we began disturbing it, it was about 280 parts per million, meaning 280 out of every molecules in the atmosphere were carbon dioxide out of every million molecules in the atmosphere. Think of a million molecules in the atmosphere, 280 of them were carbon dioxide. They're now 425, so it's increased by about 50%. Half again as much. And we would have not 425 now, but about 540 parts per million, which would be unlivable. And yet we just keep on going. We've always been doing burning these fuels and harvesting our forests, and we're just going to keep doing it that way.
It's what Homo sapien is really good at, using the environment for short-term benefit.
Yes.
Regard.
I just served on a committee that wrote a report in Massachusetts on forests for climate change, for addressing climate change, with 12 people with expertise in forestry, that is the management of forests and climate change. And while I was putting that together, it just occurred to me, I should have thought of this a long time ago, natural systems, forests in particular, we'll talk about, have been considered either to be a natural resource to be exploited for profit or a barrier to urban development and agricultural development. And so we'll clear them.
Yeah.
Without any thought as to the implications of that. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but I'm just saying so it's now kind of 100% on that side. And we totally didn't realize that forests and other ecosystems, wetlands, oceans, are essential components of the Earth's operating system, the system that maintains the climate, the rainfall, the amount of sun we get, everything we need that keeps us alive. These are the essential components that make it happen. We don't do much to help that, and we do a lot to harm it.
About 5 minutes left in this program. So we need 3 hours more. so let me just throw it open to both of you. And how do we fix this? How do we get people to wake up and smell the coffee, figure out that we need to do something different than what we're doing? any? I'll let you go first, and then we'll ask Dick whether he's got a magic lever that will bump things into a different gear.
But Dick has been in the business of developing these policies. I'd like to hear from him because he's obviously had a hand in doing some pretty constructive things in Vermont.
All right.
Well, thanks. Lyndon Johnson described politics as the art of the possible.
Yeah.
And the fact is what we have done in Vermont is not nearly what we should have done.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Carter in 1979 referred to energy conservation as the moral equivalent of war.
Yes.
And in that speech, he said, we can start now and do it gradually and relatively painlessly, or we can wait 30 years and have a crisis on our hands. Well, we've waited 45 years, and yes. we have a crisis on our hands. That's not a surprise. One thing I would say is that green energy, responsible energy is ultimately, and you've described it, cheaper than dirty. But it is more expensive to get into and to get started with it. And in Vermont politics, in this election, the whole idea of environmental responsibility on global warming has become a class issue.
Yeah,
the argument is made that the liberal elitists who can afford solar panels are forcing their agenda down the throats of real working people. And the fact is the whole package, the whole legislative agenda has been to try to help make it more affordable to get into the greener technology because ultimately, it will save people money. I don't think we've been able to communicate that as well as I wish we had. But the other thing is, even if it were more expensive, no one in 1941 said, well, it would be a good thing to defeat the Nazis. But, you know, I don't know, this rationing gasoline and sugar stuff, that's going too far.
Yeah, I know.
We have to, because the fact is, if someone thinks they can't afford green energy, they damn sure can't afford global warming.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have made many, many, many compromises to get legislation through. I almost voted against what we did this year because I thought it wasn't doing enough. As I say, it's the art of the possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Vermont already does an enormous amount by having the amount of forested area it has.
Yeah. Yes.
But there's a lot of talk about, well, let's plant some trees. Well, that's a good thing to do, no question about it, but we cannot plant our way out of climate change. Those trees will not absorb enough carbon. Newly planted trees will not absorb enough carbon between now and the time we need it. But the forests that are already growing are absorbing vast amounts of carbon dioxide, and they will do more in the future. For example, the forests of New England are at a stage of we have very little in the way of old growth forests. They have little patches of it.
Yeah.
And the Forest Service seems intent on wanting to cut those down.
You got to make it quick. We only have about 60 seconds left in this program.
Okay. Sorry, I took so much time.
letting more forests grow is essential. The other thing, if Vermont can do, Burlington can avoid this continued burning of wood to make electricity and calling it carbon neutral, which it's not. It releases more carbon dioxide than burning coal. And then you lose the capacity of forests that are really absorbing carbon in their middle age by replacing them with newly planted little trees that won't do anything in the decades where we need it. So those are just some important things for Vermont. And otherwise, Vermont is actually doing a lot of good things, no question about it.
All right. Thanks so much to both of you for joining our program today. And thanks to our sponsors. And this is WFVR-FM 96.5 on the FM dial. And now we're on to Democracy Now!